for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. Today, we're looking through the lens of moral values. And what moral values means, our quote for the day from William Grider: everyone's values are defined by what they will tolerate when it is done to others. Interesting. Interesting quote for the day. Vigils, by the way, last night after the 2,000th death in Iraq. I'm very proud to have stood in solidarity with mothers who lost their sons and other Oregonians, and actually people from around the country. There were several people from out of state there as well. Here in downtown Portland last night, people who care about morality, public morality, as opposed to people who are only obsessed with private morality, the public morality of, for example, war. And we'll get into that in a little later after I talk to one of my favorite objectivists on the planet, Dr. Yaron Brook. Hey, Yaron.
Hey.
Glad to have you with us. A question. Here we have the Roche AG, the company in Switzerland that makes Tamiflu, saying that they are not going to license the drug, that they won't give up their patent. And that now, actually, there was an announcement yesterday that they're going to suspend shipments to Canada, I guess. They're concerned that, you know, the stuff is being, you know, it's going away. At what point do we say breaking a patent is more important than, or that sustaining a patent is more important than the lives of millions of people?
Well, I don't think that's the issue, Hugh. I think that that the company has every incentive, and I think we will see that it will follow through on that incentive to produce as much Tamiflu as it can sell, because it's a selfish profit-seeking enterprise. It wants to make a lot of money, and if demand is there, and demand clearly is there right now, it will find ways whether it increases production itself or whether it licenses it to generic companies to create more of this vaccine. But if we do steal the patent, if we do take it and have the government start producing it, we are then guaranteed that better drugs, I know that Merck, for example, is working on a better flu vaccine than Tamiflu, those drugs won't be produced because the companies will know that they won't be able to benefit from them, they won't be able to make the profit off of them, they won't invest in the research and development necessary to create these drugs.
Yeah, well, you make a good point, and it's an interesting discussion that really started in the United States. Thomas Jefferson arguing against patent laws altogether, saying that nothing should be held under patent or under trademark, and he didn't prevail in that argument, of course. But now we have trademark laws, patent laws, intellectual property laws that in many cases are extending way beyond the life of a human being. I mean, we've seen trademark laws recently extended to 75 years just for the benefit of the Disney Corporation. At what point do we start saying, hey, enough already, you've made your money off your intellectual property, now it's time for this to be part of the greater public good?
Well, you know, I don't believe in a greater public good as an entity. You know, goods are things are good for individuals. But I don't know when, you know, what the exact date is that whether 75 years is right or whether 35 years is right. And indeed, for drugs, it's nowhere near 75 years. It's much, much shorter than that. But, for example, the Disney Corporation is not an issue of somebody dying and therefore losing the copyright. Here we're talking about a corporate entity that continues to exist, that continues to own the Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, and I guess the other trademarks that it has. It continues to use those as part of its identity. And I think it's completely legitimate for an entity like a corporation that doesn't just have a lifespan and then dies and goes away to continue to hold on to them. With drugs, it's much shorter than that. We have companies making generic drugs legally and legitimately through patents. And I think it's really important. Intellectual property rights, particularly with regard to inventions like drugs, are crucial. There is no fundamental difference between property rights over intellectual property and over material property.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that point. Yeah. I'm if you and I are in agreement on that.
Sure.
However, I think that there is a point at which you have to be able to say that the ability to control, to withhold something that may have value, even a purely intellectual product, a work of literature, for example, should, at the very least, end with the life of the person. Don't you think?
Well, I no.
I mean, let's get back to this discussion of public versus the private good. You suggest that there is no such thing as the public good.
Yeah.
I mean, this really gets to the heart of the argument or the discussion that we're having here. So let's just chunk up to the big issue.
Well, I don't think there is such a thing as a public as an entity. Publics are made up of individuals, and once we violate the rights of one individual in order to benefit another individual, that is harmful to all individuals in principle, and therefore is bad for the public.
Do you think there's such a thing as a family?
We do this all the time. This is the issue with eminent domain. This is the issue of intellectual property rights. We try, in the name of the public, we go after the rights of individuals, and as a consequence, I think all of us lose. Everybody.
So do you believe that there's an entity called a family?
Sure, there's an entity called a family. There's a word called the public, but it represents a conglomeration of individuals, the basic unit, the fundamental unit in a family, as well as in public, is the individual, and it's only it's the individual's rights that need to be protected, and as a consequence, the public, the family, is better off.
But what about the society? You're saying society as a whole doesn't exist in your mind as an entity that, but a family does. I mean, where do you draw the line? Is it a clan? Is it a tribe? Is it a community? At what point do we, just let me get this out, at what point do we collectively get together and say, okay, we are going to collectively work in our benefit, even if it doesn't always help out, you know, Tom or Yaron or anybody else?
Well, at no point. I think the only point of getting together, at no point in the sense that we authorize the use of force against Tom and Yaron in order to violate their rights. But I think we get together all the time. Indeed, a family entity is an entity where we get together and we work together to achieve a goal. But we also have divorce when that doesn't work, where we feel that this is not working to our mutual benefit, and then we can separate. So I am all for voluntary arrangements in which we all get together to work for a particular goal. I think a corporate entity, a partnership, any business is a way in which people get together in order to work for a common goal, and they sometimes disagree, and sometimes people leave, and sometimes people join. I'm all for voluntary cooperation. I think that's how society grows. That's how capitalism works. That's how America. That's how America functions. What I'm against is when you start forcing people to do things they don't want to do. So the goal of government is to protect the rights of individuals.
Yeah, it sounds so nice.
Whether it's good for the public, whether a particular group, a majority or a minority, thinks it's good for the public or not is irrelevant. What is relevant is the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
But the right, you know, my right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and your right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness may be changed by somebody else's right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. If the corporation down the street, for example, decides that they just want to, you know, blow more arsenic into the air,
if that arsenic into the air is a threat to your life, literally an objective threat to your life, then you can pursue them in a court system. That's what we have courts for. The point is that there is no conflict between rights. The right to life is my right to life in no way is going to conflict with your right to life. There is no such conflict. And in any case, there is no public right that somehow supersedes an individual right. If I do something to hurt you, to threaten your life or to put your life in jeopardy, you have every right to defend yourself and you have every right to use government in that defense. That's the purpose of government. The purpose of government is to arbitrate disputes between people and to protect the individual rights of one person.
But never to protect society because there's no such thing as society.
The best protection for society, to the extent that there is such a thing, is the protection of the individual rights of each one of us individuals. That is what society is. Society is just a conglomeration of individuals. There is no way to protect society by violating any individual's rights. A majority cannot vote to take away my freedom of speech, or should not be able to vote, to take away my freedom of speech in the name of it's better for society.
So if you're the guy, if you're the guy, for example, who has all the food, you know, you're and everybody else is starving, society shouldn't have the right to say, hey, share some of that food with us.
Well, you can create these artificial scenarios that doesn't exist. And even in the case of Tamiflu, again, Roche has every incentive to create more of it because they're going to make more and more money than more of it.
Yeah, they just sold 20 million doses of this stuff to the U.S. at $100 a dose.
I think it's great that they make money off of it. It provides a wonderful incentive.
You're on
more and more new medications to come about.
AynRand.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA, I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true, and the whole blessed world, all the little boys and girls, are counting on the old red, white, and blue.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. We were talking in the last segment with Dr. Yaron Brook with the Ayn Rand Institute, AynRand.org, and championing the objectivist point of view, which you find strongly influencing conservative thought in America, the Cato Institute and whatnot. And occasionally, these guys, there are some fundamental, there are some fundamental principles that are, not entirely unreasonable, like, if somebody can make some money at doing something, then they have an incentive to do it. The problem is that when you don't acknowledge that there is such a thing as a social contract, for example, they say, well, I never signed a contract. I never signed any social contract. There is no social contract, especially if you can, This is an argument that is commonly used. By the way, a great website on this, world.std.com/mhubanfac. If you go to our website, and just I use it as a signature for my posts these days, because it's just such a great libertarian, frequently asked questions kind of response. And they note the argument that I never signed no stinking social contract. That argument, and some of the following libertarian arguments are commonly quoted. For example, the Constitution and our laws are written contracts with the government. These are means by which people make social contracts with the government. The commonest is when your parents choose your residency, your citizenship, or your birth. In that case, your parents or guardians are contracting for you. It doesn't require any action on your part. You didn't sign a contract. But here we are. We're born in this country. We're part of this country. And there is a social contract. There simply is. It's real. You can't avoid it. There is a thing called society, and this is where, in my opinion, the arguments, so many of the so-called conservatives, set aside Ayn Rand and Yaron and whatnot, just the whole notion that if you simply allow greed to drive every decision, ultimately what you're going to have is a society in chaos, a society that's breaking down. And this is what we're seeing right now in the Republican Party. This is what you're seeing right now in Washington, D.C. You're seeing a society that's disintegrating as a result of, we'll just let the free market deal with everything. And in the free market, it's, whoever has the most money has the most power, because the money is power. And so here now you have K Street, where lobbying firms that employ Democrats are essentially not allowed to talk to people in Congress, in the House and Senate, Republicans in the House and Senate. It's just one example. The kind of things where it really starts to break down. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. 866-440-THOM. Nick in Pueblo, Colorado on the line. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Well, Tom, I just got in the middle of your discussion with the gentleman you just had on there, and when you mentioned something about a corporation building this plant next to your house, and it's spewing this arsenic, and he gave the typical answer that they give, well, that's what the court system's for. Well, ASARCO, Copper Industries, I don't know if you're familiar with them or not. They owe more than $1 billion in environmental fines levied against them, and they're in and out of court every day, and it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, well, it becomes a cost of doing business. And here's the larger question. The court system didn't just come into being, you know, along with the instantaneous birth of the country or something. It didn't just, you know, poof, we have a court system. The court system is a creation of we the people, of society. We decided what the laws would be. We decided what the rules would be. And the court system simply enforces those. So to say on the one hand, well, we don't have society, but we do have a court system to enforce, that's the point where it starts breaking down. Thanks a lot, Nick, for the call. Yeah. Good to hear from you. Eddie in Danville, Virginia. Hey, Eddie, welcome to the program.
How are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'd like to get your views on the new eminent domain law that the Supreme Court ruled on, where they can take your property for financial gain of the community.
Okay. You're talking the Kelso ruling you're talking about by the Supreme Court.
Right.
I think it was wrong. I just think it was totally wrong. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which is, I've got a copy of it around here someplace. There we go. Fifth Amendment of the Constitution lays out this thing that says, basically, you can't snatch somebody's property, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And what the founders meant when they put that thing in there was to say that, you know, if we're going to build a road and we have to take your house or your land in order to build that road, we're going to pay you. And that society has the right to take things from us if we collectively agree that this is, you know, for the public good. And now what happened with the Supreme Court is that the Supreme Court said, you know, we're going to take that, you know, a whole step farther and say, well, the public good is defined by the amount of taxes that are being paid to the government entities. And, you know, the more corporate activity you have, the more taxes are paid. And so, you know, let's bring in bigger corporations. And that's where it just really totally broke down for me. So I think the Kelso decision was absolutely wrong. I think most progressives agree with me that it's wrong, although for some reason the conservatives like to say that it was liberals on the court. There are no liberals on this court. So that's my take on it, Eddie, in answer to your question. Thanks for the call. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's just time to pay the price, not listening to advice, deciding in your youth on the policy.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program. Thurman in Lincoln, Nebraska on the line. Hey, Thurman, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to comment on that eminent domain law.
Sure. On the Kelso decision of the Supreme Court last year.
Right.
Or is it Kelo?
I'm sorry?
Is it Kelo or Kelso? I don't have it in front of me. In any case, yes, we both know what we're talking about, so go for it.
Yeah, I agree that that wasn't a liberal decision, but I think the reason why they decided that way is because if they were to decide any other way, it would throw the rail system, it would throw all sorts of private property up in the air because a lot of that property was built and handed over to private entities.
Well, and this
Indian
is
Indian tribes.
Yeah, this is where it started. Really, was in the 1870s when eminent domain was used to take in cities in particular, because most of the railroad land that was given to the railroads in the 1870s, 1880s was taken from Native Americans, or it was, you know, by in the mind of the American government was considered free land or found land or whatever. But a lot of land was taken and given to the railroads. But back at that point in time, in order to create a corporation, in order to create the railroad corporations, you had to jump through all kinds of hoops. I mean, this was a huge, huge thing to create a railroad corporation. And they had a very high level of accountability. In fact, Thurman, let me just share with you. I've got to plug this thing in. It'll take just a second. But let me just share. Do you know who William Jennings Bryan was?
Yeah.
Okay. He ran for president 3 times. You know, he've argued the Scopes case. He was a famous Democratic politician of the last century. early years. And here's a recording that was made by Thomas Edison of Williams Jennings Bryan about this issue with regard to the railroads. Just check this out and let me know what you think here.
The Railroad Question by William Jennings Bryan, Edison Records. The right of the government to regulate the railroads has been established in both state and federal courts. The railroad is a quasi-public corporation.
There's the key.
As such, it exercises the sovereign right of eminent domain, and it cannot escape from this public character. What we need is first to ascertain the value of the railroads.
Now, let me just interrupt Brian here for a second and point out that what he says, first of all, that a corporation is a public-private entity. That is to say, a corporation is brought into existence by the consent of the public. It requires the state to say, okay, you can have a corporation. The Secretary of State, in the case of current laws, back then, actually, you had to have in an individual state or at a federal level, you had to have a legislator introduce a bill to authorize the corporation. Secondly, the railroad corporations were using eminent domain, but what he's saying is it works both ways. If the railroads and the government together can use eminent domain, then the government has the power of eminent domain over the railroads. Here he continues.
Measured by the cost of reproduction, and second, to prevent for the future issues of fictitious capital and watered stock.
Now, that was just, you know, one of the things. There was all these scandals in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s of the railroads watering down their own stock, just to, you know, selling stock that was essentially worthless to raise money. And a lot of people got badly burned, and the robber barons got very rich. Anyhow, he continues.
When we have put railroad business upon an honest basis, we can proceed with rate reductions without, however, preventing a fair and just return upon the capital invested.
See, and this is where he's arguing in favor of essentially a regulated transport system. He's saying, you know, let's let the railroad companies make money. Let's let their stockholders make money. But, you know, we have to make sure that there's, you know, the reasonable fares are charged.
Just now, there is considerable discussion as to the relative sphere of the nation and the state. And some have taken the position that railroads should be given national incorporation. The Democratic position, however, is that national remedies should be added to state remedies and not substituted for them. The states should not be deprived of the power which they now have to protect their people against railroad abuses.
See, this is, again, the railroads were arguing in favor. They started the whole corporate personhood thing in 1886 with the Santa Clara County decision versus Southern Pacific Railroad at the Supreme Court level. Which sort of began all this, and now he's saying, you know, you have state remedies. Let's not give the railroads more power by allowing them to decide when eminent domain will be exercised rather than exclusively limiting that power to the government.
Congress does not need any additional power. It has more power now than it has exercised and is by the Constitution given full control over interstate commerce. It is not necessary that Congress shall control commerce within a state.
This is the key now. He's saying, let the individual states protect themselves from the railroads, but the Interstate Commerce Clause in the Constitution is the place where the federal government actually has the authority to regulate the railroads. And we don't need to mess with these laws because, what he was basically prophesying, you know, looking forward and seeing in the future here, prophesying, was this Kelo decision, this decision from the Supreme Court.
In order to effectively regulate interstate commerce, the present demand for national incorporation is not in the interest of the public, but in the interest of the railroads. But the people, Republicans and Democrats, will refuse to surrender any of the power now lodged in the states. This is not a revival of the doctrine of secession, as some of the railroad magnates have tried to make it appear.
Yeah, in fact, the railroads were saying, well, you're talking about, you know, states having so much power that they're effectively seceding from the country, right?
The question is not whether a state has the right to secede, but whether a state remaining in the Union shall be permitted to exercise the power vested in it by the Constitution for the protection of the rights of the people of the state.
So there you go. William Jennings Bryan, a recording, I'm not sure the year on that. I think it was probably around 1912 or 1913, something like that. This is an argument that goes back a long, long way, and you correctly point that out, Thurman.
Oh, well, I just thought, given the composition of the court, there's no other way they would have ruled because a lot of property in the country would then become, for grabs.
Well, actually, I think they could have ruled down the middle on this thing. They could have said there are times when, well, see, the deal that we had with the railroads was we will give you this land in exchange for your being under our control. The railroads were highly regulated industries up until the 1880s, 1890s, when they started really the whole. I mean, there was this whole series of Supreme Court decisions that I write about in my book on equal protection, where the railroads were basically trying to disentangle themselves from regulation.
Right.
And they had been given all that land free under eminent domain in exchange for being regulated entities. And then
and then
once they had the land and the power, they started buying off politicians and saying, we don't want to be regulated anymore.
Yeah, but given the composition of the court, like I said, I think it's a protection of corporate interests as opposed to, you know, the people.
Oh, and because you mean because the court is essentially a conservative court, and most of the folks on the Supreme Court right now are really, with a possible exception of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, are really more interested in protecting corporate interests than personal interests,
right.
Individual interests. Yeah, okay.
Right.
I agree with you. Good point. You wanted to make another point? No, that was it. Okay, thanks a lot, Thurman. Good to hear from you. Vince in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Hey, Vince, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Doing a good job. I'd like to say a few words about the episode going on right now in Florida, and I was watching the big lines at the service stations. First of all, I thought that Governor Bush of Florida should have made sure that all those service stations had backup generators. He's blaming the public. They knew about it. They should have had 72 hours of water and on, all these excuses when he, in fact, is guilty of not making sure that people get only $20 in gas and that they all have generators. So
well, you see, I think he just discovered that his state has hurricanes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, it was on 9/11 that George Bush discovered that he'd had 56 memos telling him that Osama bin Laden was going to attack the United States. it seems to run in the family.
I know, but the point I want to make here is that these oil companies are just out of control. And I believe in capitalism, although I do think that people confuse capitalism with democracy. I think that one's an economic policy and the other is a political principle, and they get the two confused. But nevertheless, this is not capitalism and competition that sets a marketplace like they try to say. What it is just greed, good old-fashioned greed.
Yep.
There'll be $800 billion given to these rich people at the top 1% of the population over the next 8 years. I just noticed in yesterday's paper that Exxon had $8.6 billion in profit the last quarter, went up 89% in the last quarter. And while all this is going on, big business is sold out to China. We are going to be $210 billion in a hole this year with China, with their...
Yeah, just with China. It's going to be almost $700 billion with the world.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that, by the way, is oil. Now, you're making excellent points, Vince, and well said, and you know, point taken. Thank you very much. Paul in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Paul, what's up? Got about a minute.
Tom, listen, I don't know if it's part of your goal or whatever when you have these libertarians on for discussion, but I get real frustrated because you could just drop a hammer on their whole argument and completely shut them down with just a couple of real simple points.
For example.
Okay, well, when that guy hung up the telephone from talking to you, he probably had to go to the bathroom by then. And when he went in there and did his business and flushed the toilet and it went somewhere and he didn't have to worry about where it went, he's a hypocrite because he just used the public sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
And when he drives his car over a bridge to get over a body of water or a ravine or something, he's a hypocrite if he doesn't put his car on his own barge and paddle it across the river and
yeah,
drive.
No,
you know,
you're making my argument, Paul. I mean, this is my Joe Republican actually argument. This whole thing.
Hypocrites and they're irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right and well said. And thank you very much, Paul. Good to hear from you, and I appreciate it. Our telephone number 1-866-440-THOM 440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, it's a grim thing. Between a rock and a hard place. Last night went down to the across the street from the Federal Building. There's a little park here in downtown Portland, and stood with Michelle DeFord and her husband, Steve, who are co-founders, along with Cindy Sheehan and a few others, of the Gold Star Families for Peace. They lost their son, David, in Iraq, and listened to the reading of the names. It was just truly, truly astounding, truly tragic what has happened in this country with George W. Bush telling his biographer in 1999, Mickey Herskowitz, that if he got to be elected president, he wouldn't squander the political capital from an invasion of Iraq like his father did. Because his daddy only had a 100-hour war, remember? And by the time the election came, all the good feelings of the war were gone, and his daddy lost the election. He wouldn't squander that political capital, George W. said. No, when he invaded Iraq, he said, he would use that political capital to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. And he certainly has, and the Republicans have used it. I mean, just as they planned, arguably. And I think that this is the tragedy for America, much more the tragedy for America as a consequence of it. What can you say? It's just not a good thing. In fact, I just a clip here that I have of Cindy Sheehan telling the story of that, probably worth remembering or worth recognizing.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush is ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president. From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000.
There's Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission. Welcome back, Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I think Cindy portrays the talks softly but carry a big stick quite well.
Yeah, she is.
When I meet libertarians nowadays, I ask a quick question that no one's been able to answer, is how does libertarianism prevent problems? It proposes a totally unnatural system you don't find in nature. There's no anticipation of problems. And when we have these problems, it can't be reversed. And they say, if somebody hurts somebody, you can go to court and sue.
What if they kill somebody?
Yeah, but how does it prevent problems? And none have been able to answer that yet. It's an unnatural system that removes everything of balance. It removes fairness. And it doesn't exist in nature.
Yeah, well, I can tell you their argument would be, fairness doesn't count, that only greed counts.
but the thing is, it does not prevent irreversible problems.
Yeah, well said, Jay.
The other aspect is, that I love that you brought up finally, is this thing about corporation.
You still there, Jeff?
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. I thought we got cut off.
No.
What I love about corporations is that, they are an artificial entity, an agreement when you create a corporation, you're getting benefits beyond the norm.
Sure.
And so why not have some restrictions? Why not have restrictions so that, say, there's a ratio of, 50 to 1 from the lowest paid person to the highest paid person? Why not restrict profits as an agreement to give other benefits?
Just reasonable, straightforward things. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. John in Seattle, Washington. Hey, John.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
It's about this libertarian... They say that there's no social contract, but then they accept money in stocks.
Right, which is part of the social contract of we the people getting together and saying, we'll have a court system, we'll have a monetary system, we'll enforce contract law. Although the argument, the only reason that we should have government is to enforce contract law and to protect the borders, basically.
Right, and then also they forget that when people think that the social contract isn't working for them, it leads them to crime.
Yeah.
If there's no reason for me to buy into this society, then it's time for me to be a libertarian and just go use whatever power I can to take.
And this is one of the reasons why it's so important to be sure that you have a society that basically works for everybody, because once society stops working for people, they view themselves as being outside of society, and they engage in criminal behavior. And at the micro level, you see that with the guy who's sticking up the 7-Eleven because he doesn't think that he'll ever get a job where he can actually raise a family anyway, so what the heck. And on the macro level, you see that with Tom DeLay saying only lobbying firms that employ Republicans are allowed to come into my office and talk to me, and only then when they have a check in their hand.
Right.
Because in both cases, they've said, social contract, we don't need no stinking social contract.
Right. And then I think even our country started because people believed that the social contract wasn't working for them. The revolution?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Because the social contract at that point in time, and it was Rousseau, by the way, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote the book The Social Contract back in the 1600s, that the founders were looking to, him and John Locke, you know, the uh-huh. early Enlightenment thinkers. And that social contract was one that said basically that royalty and money ruled. And the founder said, no, that's not a social contract we want to be part of.
And then it can get ugly like the French Revolution.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where it broke down. And in fact, when Jefferson looked back, and John, thank you for the call, Jefferson looked back and his, you know, sometimes the Tree of Liberty requires the blood of patriots, speaking of the French Revolution. And then later when he saw the terrors, you know, Robespierre and the whole the way it went down, he regretted having said that to in particular around the French Revolution. And again, that was the breakdown of a social contract, or the replacement of one by one that was highly dysfunctional, shall we say. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our big story for the day, I suppose. The big event of the moment. Harriet Myers. She's saying... Harriet Myers steps down. She's saying that she's stepping down because, you know, she's got these private documents between her and the president, and Congress insists on seeing them, and because she can't reveal them, she's got to step down. And that's what Bush is saying. This is kind of the White House line. Of course, there were all those private documents that John Roberts had that Bush refused to turn over to Congress, and Congress held hearings anyway, and they said, okay, fine. John Roberts can sit on the Supreme Court. And those documents still haven't been seen. So we know that this is nonsense. Obviously, what really happened here is that the Reich rose up and said to Bush, no, you cannot. This woman is not sufficiently hard right for us. And Bush had to bow to them. And now they're looking, you know, early speculation, Michael McConnell. I mean, I'm telling you, a lot of speculation about Michael McConnell. I wouldn't take out of the running at this point altogether. I wouldn't take out of the running also Priscilla Owens or Janice Rogers Brown. You know, again, it's supposed to be a woman's position. We'll see. Although I have a feeling right now, you know, if it's true that George nominated Harriet because his wife suggested to him that he should, that he's now kind of thumbing his nose at her, saying, see, I told you it wouldn't work. I'm going to go with a white guy. So, you know, I don't know how Laura's feeling about this and don't really care. I mean, that's not the point. But we'll see. But my guess is that if they can come up with some really hard right-wing extremist, a Bork with a friendly face, a Bork who doesn't have strange facial hair, and drop that guy's name 15 minutes after the indictments against Rove and Libby and maybe even Cheney come out of the prosecutor's office, They'll grab a hold of the news cycle once more and spin the thing, and on we go. And we once again won't be discussing the crimes of this war, and we once again won't be discussing, which is what led to the lies, which is what led to the outing of the CIA agent, which is what led to the indictments, which I am predicting, by coincidence, they will grab out of the news cycle by announcing the next nominee instead. We'll see how it goes. David Swanson is with us, afterdowningstreet.org. Welcome, David, to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. You were going to be down at the White House yesterday with Cindy Sheehan. How come you're not in jail?
We got out about 11 p.m. or midnight last night.
So you both got arrested yesterday?
26 of us did, 14 men and 12 women, including Cindy Sheehan and including Anne Wright, who you may know, the career diplomat who resigned over the war, and a number of other familiar faces.
I'm a little surprised, I suppose I shouldn't be, but a little surprised that I didn't see any reference to this in the New York Times this morning, or at least in the early, on the obvious front pages of the New York Times that I scanned online. It wasn't in any of our local papers. Did you notice if, I mean, was there press there? Is this thing getting play in Washington, D.C.? Is it a story that's going to run outside the Beltway?
Well, as someone who refuses to purchase the New York Times, I get my news on the Internet, and it's all over the Internet. There's Associated Press stories and AFP stories and all the wire services and various papers. And, yeah, there was tons of media there, as there is anywhere that Cindy Sheehan steps outside of a building.
Yeah, yeah, good. I hope that this story has legs. I was talking with Ellen Ratner yesterday and the Talk Radio News Service. Her brother Michael she's a White House correspondent, and her brother Michael is the attorney who's suing Don Rumsfeld in Germany right now, among other things. And she made the point, and I told her that what you guys were doing, and that Cindy had told me on my morning program 3 or 4 days ago that she was going to go back and get arrested day after day. And Ellen said, be very careful. If you do that, given the court system in Washington, D.C., they may just throw you in jail for, 90 days or for 6 months or for a year. And or in the case of the Bush administration, until November of 2008, just by coincidence, and effectively silence you. Have you guys thought about strategy on this?
Well, Cindy has announced, and many people, 384 people got arrested back in late September, and Cindy is among those who have not paid the $75 and are planning to go to court and challenge that arrest some months from now. And the rule is that when you get arrested a second time and you have an outstanding arrest, they keep you in jail until your next court date, or rather until the second court date. And they waived that last night for a handful of people, including Cindy. When Cindy shows up at Anacostia Jail tonight, they are very likely to hold her for, it could be until sometime in January or February.
Right, which takes her voice out of the public dialogue. That doesn't seem like a smart thing to do to me.
Well, it does so very dramatically because she has an invitation to speak at the National Press Club at 9 a.m. on Friday. All of the media will be there. I've been in touch with C-SPAN and CNN and the rest, and they will all be there. But on the other hand, her voice has been in the media for months. Public opinion is overwhelmingly with her, and yet in what we call a democracy, nothing is happening. So
from jail, she could become a Nelson Mandela-like figure and essentially reach out of the jail cell, even if her voice can't be heard. Her presence there would be a rallying cry.
I think so. I think it might. And in any case, it's not my decision. There are many who have counseled Cindy exactly as you would have a moment ago, but she has committed herself to not paying one dime in fines and not stopping the civil disobedience. So if you want to see Cindy and act with Cindy, she's at the White House right now, and get down there by 6 p.m. Eastern time and do this with her.
Yeah, and this may be the last chance. It was the old Apple commercial, oddly, here, a for-profit corporation, essentially saying thank goodness for the folks among us who push the edges, for the for the eccentrics or the people who don't play by the rules. I'm forgetting the exact phrase, but Cindy has always been the one stepping out on the edge, and it has the price to her personally and to her family has been very high, and I think our society is better for it. We just have to honor her in that.
Oh, she's what? Done a tremendous job, and she's exhausted from it, but she's not about to stop.
Yeah, yeah. And what about you, David Swanson?
What about me?
Well, what are your plans here? Are you planning on getting arrested serially, or are you going to continue running after DowningStreet.org?
Tonight I may give rides. They let you out of the jail in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, and, you can't walk to the metro or anywhere else, and so people have to give rides and provide some food for people who've been standing in jail for hours. I may do that. I think that I'm of more use getting work done than being in jail for months.
Yeah.
And certainly to my family as well. But people who haven't done it once or have but have already paid their fine and had it processed, it's too fast. I can't pay my fine and get it processed in a day and get back in tonight.
Yeah.
In a week, I can be back in there.
So you're calling for people to have an ongoing process of getting arrested in front of the White House as long as this war is going on?
Absolutely, and I think possibly even more effectively, particularly if Cindy is not with us, on November 18th, everyone is going to practice civil disobedience at recruiting stations. And, even now, between now and then, legally, we need parents to be in front of high schools turning the recruiters away. This is a legal and effective action. But on November 18th, Iraq Pledge of Resistance and numerous other groups are encouraging people to go and occupy and disrupt nonviolently recruiting stations and stop them from recruiting our kids into this war.
Yeah, an important thing, and the reality is that an awful lot of the recruiting that's being done in the high schools is not being done in person. I mean, the No Child Left Behind law requires the schools to be passing along all the private and personal information about our kids to the recruiters.
That's right.
And unless you intentionally opt out, and then you may, by opting out, by taking your kid out of the program, you may be making them ineligible for certain kinds of college loans and things. I mean, it's absolutely Byzantine or bizarre. It's amazing times we live in. David Swanson, good on you for having the courage to stand up yesterday and get arrested in front of the White House. After DowningStreet.org, the website. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen, I was just a few minutes ago.
You got me now?
Yeah, I was, and just a few minutes ago, can you hear me, Ellen?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I was just talking with David Swanson, who was arrested with Cindy Sheehan last night, and shared with him to share with her your advice from our conversation yesterday about don't get arrested too many times because then you're in jail and they'll shut you up. And he said that he thinks that her strategy is to essentially become a Nelson Mandela, to actually be in jail. And that will draw attention to things in ways that maybe not being in jail can't.
Well, I wish I could say that were true, but I don't have great hopes because the press in this country is a little different than the international press, and we tend to forget things very quickly and not pay attention to anything that isn't making a lot of noise on a daily basis.
Yeah, well, in any case, she's gonna go ahead and do it, so we'll see how it plays out. The top news, I suppose, is Harriet Myers?
Yes, And, of course, the thought is that Bush has to be in some big trouble because he must shore up his base, and that's exactly why he's doing this with Harriet Myers. And, of course, nobody believes that she just resigned on her own. This was clearly a decision that was made. Now, what's very interesting is that the special prosecutor, speaking of, I believe that he's doing this again so that he will get a lot more people really making, he will get his base really on his side. But I think that what we're seeing is we're seeing that the special prosecutor has not come out with indictments, may not come out with them this time around, may even go to a new grand jury, and rumor around town is, and it has been in some of the press, but of course one never totally knows, is that he is taking more space here in Washington. Now, if you're taking more space,
You mean renting office space?
That's right.
Yeah.
You are prepared for the long haul, and his modus operandi as a prosecutor is to indict somebody first and then to indict more people later. That's how he tends to operate.
Yeah. Well, it's getting your foot in the door, essentially, and then you know, sweeping the room kind of thing. I mean,
exactly, and getting one person to sing on the other person and then sort of moving ahead that way in a very deliberate manner.
Right.
This is exactly why Bush has to get rid of Myers. He has got to throw red meat to his base, or he is going to lose the little support he has.
Well, not only that, what do you want to bet, Ellen Ratner, that the moment that an indictment is named by Fitzgerald, that 5 minutes later the White House is going to suddenly decide that that's the time that they have to tell us who their nominee for the Supreme Court is going to be?
Well, that's right. And watch, 30 to 60 days hence, Bush is going to begin to look tough on immigration, too. So he's just going to go sort of right down the needs of his base. And what's very interesting is Republicans are in strategy sessions all day behind closed doors. I was just on the Hill, and that's how the Republicans are handling things.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, we learned yesterday, for example, Gordon Smith, the Republican senator from Oregon, coming out and saying that in Oregon, the whole issue of drilling in Anwar, Caribou is no longer a lightning rod issue. Apparently the Rick Santorum did a presentation to a group of Republicans yesterday in which he suggested that the new polling that the Republicans are doing, because the gas prices have gone up so much.
People are not caring about that. Now, this afternoon, yeah. Senator Kennedy and several other senators are meeting. They're going to have a press conference at about 2:30 our time this afternoon, East Coast time, to talk about the outrageous amount of money that Exxon has made. I think $9 billion this quarter.
That's
something
right.
Like that.
Yeah, in
and
one quarter, a greater profit than some of the Cisco systems or some of the largest IT companies.
It could provide everybody's. If they gave up one quarter of profits, it could heat everybody's home that is going to have to suffer this year and go cold because of the oil prices. And
yeah.
That's just one company.
Yeah. Yeah, but it ain't going to happen. I mean, it's just,
right.
But yeah. So
that is. There's going to be a press conference this afternoon. The Democrats are valiantly trying to get some traction, not only on this. They did get some traction yesterday on the Davis-Bacon bill.
Uh huh. Okay. Good. Anything else happening there in Washington D.C. that you think we should know about, Ellen?
The major thing, the only other thing is that the Republicans are trying to do $40 billion to $50 billion in cuts. They want a 2% across-the-board cut in all kinds of domestic spending. And what that would mean, for instance, is 1,000 slots in Head Start go away in one state alone, and that would be Mississippi.
Yeah, which just got whacked really badly by a hurricane. And Medicare and Medicaid, they're talking about cutting back on these programs.
Oh, those are definitely they're trying to cut down on the prescription drugs, delay its implementation, et cetera. We're going to see, this is going to be holy war.
This is pandering to their base big time, in that their base is big time corporate America. But what about the risk of the middle American voter who voted Republican last time? Aren't they going to destroy that?
Well, I think honestly, Tom, that it absolutely that they do have to worry about that risk. But you know the way they're talking, they think they may lose the House, but they have a choice. they have to shore up their presidency with the political capital that they can get for him, where it's really finished.
First things first. 27 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Ellen.
You got it.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Say what you want, mean what you say.
And welcome back, my friends. Remember Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hello, see what you've been missing. Some of the finest minds in the whole internet on the whole planet. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, if you'd like to call in. I got to tell you about the world's laziest flasher. And no, we're not, this is not a Tom DeLay joke. But it actually, this does tie into a more serious story. Actually, a very serious story, which we'll get to in just a second. But first, a Wisconsin man is in big trouble for photographing his, making copies and leaving them on women's windshields in at least four towns. This is in the Associated Press from the United Press International, the Mooney Network. Jeffrey John Hine, 40, currently faces 30 charges of lewd and lascivious behavior for disseminating his private business throughout Hartford and West Bend, and police in Germantown and Menominee Falls told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel he violated their penal codes as well. No pun intended. Two of the criminal complaints say Hine got his artistic inspiration from a website called I Shot Myself, which advises its readers to pickle yourself in the adrenaline rush of public nudity, the Journal Sentinel said. Now, here's this guy. I don't know. Maybe I'm sheltered or something. Being a flasher has never. It's like. I suppose there are some things that some weird things that it's possible to empathize with or understand or imagine even. But it's why somebody would get excited about exposing themselves to somebody else. Number one, I don't understand. But number two, what little understanding of it I have, my assumption was, I guess that's the word, is that the thrill was in watching the response of the victim, not in just doing it. It seems so. Here, this guy's just like the world's laziest flasher. Well, from a sexual assault, essentially. I mean, this is what this was really, is a kind of a form of sexual assault. From the world's laziest flasher to a young Tucson woman who really was sexually assaulted. I mean, not to say that the people who got this guy's photograph under their windshields weren't in some way assaulted. Not to minimize that. But this is a woman who was raped. A young Tucson woman. This is from the Arizona Daily Star. Article by Carla McLean. A young woman who was raped spent three frantic days trying to obtain the drug to prevent a pregnancy. Now, notice those three magic words, prevent a pregnancy. We're not talking about cause an abortion. We're talking about prevent a pregnancy. Knowing that each passing day lowered the chance the drug would work. She called dozens of Tucson pharmacies trying to fill the prescription. Most don't stock the drug. When she finally did, I'm here reading from the article, when she finally did find a pharmacy with it, she said she was told the pharmacist on duty would not dispense it because of religious and moral objections. Now, and a pharmacist, I mean, a pharmacist has to understand basic reproductive biology. And the fact of the matter is, somebody has sex or somebody gets raped in this case, conception does not occur immediately. The sperm doesn't say hello to the egg in those moments. It takes 3 days for those little sperms to work their way up through into the fallopian tubes, all the way up through the uterus, into the fallopian tubes, which is where fertilization occurs. And so if you can dose somebody with a high enough dose of hormones, of estrogen and progesterone, I believe are the hormones that they use, you give them a high enough dose, it'll prevent ovulation. It'll prevent that egg from being available when that sperm shows up, and you won't have conception. In other words, we're talking birth control. We're not talking abortion. This is, you know, I have been saying for some time that the anti-abortion agenda in this country, that the real hardcore anti-abortion folks are really, they're using, exploiting the good sentiments, the kindnesses, the concerns about human life and about, you know, with their pictures of dismembered, you know, fetuses and babies and whatnot. They're exploiting the goodness and kind empathy of Americans when really their agenda is one of controlling women. Really their agenda is going back to patriarchy in the United States. Really their agenda is to roll back the right of a woman to even choose whether or not she becomes pregnant. And people, you know, you say this a couple of years ago and people go, oh, you're being paranoid. You know, yeah, we know the Catholic Church is opposed to contraception, but, you know, that doesn't mean that that's really what's going on. In fact, Italy, probably arguably one of the most Catholic countries in the world, has the highest rate of use of birth control devices in the world. Italy. A little irony for you. You know, it's where the Vatican is located. But in any case, you know, I was shocked, says the 20-year-old woman, who, as a victim of sexual assault, is not being named by the Star. She said, I just did not understand how they could legally refuse to do this. Keep in mind, again, we're not talking about abortion here. We're talking about a woman who was raped and a pharmacist refusing to give her the morning after pill, the drug that the FDA doesn't want to make an over-the-counter drug because the fundamentalists associated with the Bush administration are all concerned about that. And this is not an abortion drug. We're not talking RU486. We're not talking a pill that will cause a fertilized egg to abort during the first month or so of pregnancy. We're talking about a pill that will prevent pregnancy from happening. They looked at 900 Arizona pharmacies and found that fewer than half of them keep emergency contraceptive drugs in stock. Now, what is a pharmacy for if not to have pharmaceuticals in stock? And if the whole role of pharmaceuticals is to help people, to save people's lives, to, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, we're here to help you. And here this woman, she's calling drugstore after drugstore after drugstore for 3 days trying to find a pharmacist that actually stocks Plan B. Finally, she finds a pharmacy who has it and is told by the pharmacist, I won't give you this. It violates my religious principles. She found a pharmacist in Tucson, Arizona, who said that his or her, I don't know, religious principles were that if you're raped and you get pregnant, that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, this is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And yet, this occurred at Fry's Pharmacy on East Grant Road in Tucson, Arizona, 3920 East Grant Road. The manager of the pharmacy, the article notes, of Fry's Pharmacy on Grant Road in Tucson, Arizona, where the refusal occurred, offered to find another location where the prescription could be filled, according to a Fry's spokeswoman. But the young woman said that she was not offered other options. So either this young woman, rape victim, was telling the truth when she said that the pharmacist at Fry's said, no, I won't give you this drug even though we have it and even though you have a legal prescription for it because it violates my religious principles. You've been raped. You should get pregnant. Apparently Fry's agrees that that was the truth. But then they're saying, but you know, we told her someplace else where she could go, and she said, no, thanks. And she's saying, nobody told me that, apparently. If this article is accurate in the Arizona Daily Star, I have no reason to believe it's not. DailyStar.com is their website, article by Carla McLean. See, this ultimately, you know, when you get right down to it, this is what it boils down to. In recent months, PPFA, and I, David, do you remember, do you know what PPFA is an acronym for? You'll check it out. Okay, thanks. In recent months, PPFA surveyed the top 50 national pharmacy chains to determine their policy regarding pharmacists' rights to refuse to fill valid legal prescriptions for birth control, including emergency contraception. And, okay, David, you're on the air.
Yes, yeah, Planned Parenthood, Federation of America.
Of course. Okay, great. Cool. Thank you very much. Planned Parenthood. And PPFA only supports those pharmacies that have a policy to ensure patients access to this. They found that pharmacies with thumbs-down position, pharmacies where the pharmacists can say, no, you can't have a drug that will prevent conception if you've been raped, include Rite Aid, Target, Walgreens, Walmart, and Winn-Dixie stores. Those are their thumbs-down ones. The pharmacies that say, you know, our pharmacist can say to you, tough luck, you have to get pregnant. It's mind-boggling. On the other hand, the pharmacies that they gave a thumbs up, Planned Parenthood a thumbs up, Brooks, Eckerd, Costco, CVS, Fagan's, Harris, Kmart, Price Chopper, and Super Value, good on them. So, amazing what's happening in the United States of America in the year 2005. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back,
yes,
my friends.
Me friend.
It's the place where smart people get their news. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. No, it couldn't be. Hey, a new report out by the GAO. This, again, this should be on the front page of the New York Times. You just have to wonder what's going on with the media in America. And we're going to be talking to Peter Phillips at the top of the next hour about what's going on in the media in America when stuff like this is not on the front page of the New York Times. Here, this, the General Accountability Office, the General Accounting Office, the GAO, was asked by the House Judiciary Committee to look into the General Accounting Office, to look into complaints, more than 57,000 complaints about the election of 2004. The GAO, this is a nonpartisan agent. I mean, these are basically folks who work for Congress, but not for a party. This is an agency of the government, the General Accounting Office. They have now found that, quote, some of the concerns about electronic voting machines have been realized and have caused problems with recent elections, resulting in the loss and miscount of votes, end quote. Now, the United States, the U.S., this country is the only major democracy that allows private partisan corporations to secretly count and tabulate votes with proprietary, non-transparent software. We are the only one. That's it. And, you know, a lot of folks are wondering, what's the deal here? For example, these are some of the things that the GAO confirmed. They confirmed some electronic voting machines did not encrypt cast ballots or system audit logs, thus making it possible to alter them without detection. End quote. This, by the way, from a piece that Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman wrote in the Free Press, freepress.org. In other words, the GAO now confirms that electronic voting machines provided an open door to flip an entire vote count. More than 800,000 votes were cast in Ohio on electronic voting machines, seven times George Bush's official margin of victory. Pretty amazing, huh? The GAO noted, it is easy to alter a file defining how a ballot appears, making it possible for someone to vote for one candidate and actually be recorded as voting for an entirely different candidate. I'm quoting from the GAO. What used to be called, apparently, the General Accounting Office, now the General Accountability Office. Oh, Government Accountability Office. Is that, there we go. Hey, Alex, pop on. Tell us about that.
Sure. Congressionally mandated office to do the research that a congressman wants done by the government. It used to be called the General Accounting Office because they did the accounting, but they were doing so much more to keep the government accountable, they changed the name.
And when was that? Was that just in the last
year? Yeah, just in the last year.
Yeah, okay. So it's now the Government Accountability Office?
The Government Accountability Office. Same building, same people, new name.
Cool. Alex, thank you so much. Alex in New York there with Air America.
Anytime.
Putting together the show for us. Mixing the board, anyway. Falsifying election results without leaving any evidence of such action by using altered memory cards can be easily done, according to the GAO. This, again, from this article by Bob Fitricus and Harvey Washburn. But I'm quoting from the GAO report, as they reported. The GAO also confirms that access to the voting network was easily compromised because not all digital recording electronic voting systems, DREs, these are the touchscreen machines, had supervisory functions password protected. So access to one machine provided access to the whole network. In other words, rigging the 2004 vote didn't require a widespread conspiracy. All it would require is somebody knowing how to tap into the network. And they'd only have to flip 118,000 votes in Ohio. Actually, they'd only have to flip half that many to take the vote away from John Kerry. Keep in mind, the exit polls in Ohio showed John Kerry won. Same in Iowa, the same in Nevada, the same in New Mexico. You know, a statistical impossibility. And yet it happened. Election officials in Mahoning County now concede that at least 18 machines visibly transferred votes for Kerry to Bush. Voters who pushed Kerry's name saw Bush's name light up again and again all day long. Officials claim the problems were quickly solved, but sworn statements and affidavits say otherwise. They confirm similar problems in Franklin County, Columbus, Ohio. Kerry's margins in both counties were suspiciously low. In Gahanna, Ward 1B at a fundamentalist church, a so-called electronic transfer glitch gave Bush nearly 4,000 extra votes when only 638 people showed up at that polling place. In Miami County, Ohio, at 1:43 a.m. after Election Day, with the county's central tabulator reporting 100% of the vote, 19,000 more votes mysteriously appeared, 13,000 for Bush. At the same percentage as prior to the additional votes. Again, a statistical impossibility. Somebody was messing with the 2004 election. John Conyers laid it out in his book, What Went Wrong in Ohio. The GAO, now the Government Accountability Office, seems to have confirmed this. Again, quoting, you know, access to the voting network was also compromised by repeated use of the same user IDs combined with easily guessed passwords. Again, quoting from the report, the GAO report, the locks protecting access to the system were easily picked and keys were simple to copy. Another quote from the report, one DRE model was shown to have networked in such a rudimentary fashion that a power failure on one machine would cause the entire network to fail. This is the system on which we're deciding who's going to be the president of the United States? Let me remind you one more time, we are the only major democracy in the world that allows private, for-profit corporations in secret to tell voters how they voted. The only one. We've got to do something about that too, my friends. And you can, by the way, make your voices heard. Rush Holt's bill is moving through Congress slowly. Call 202-225-3121 if you'd like to talk to your member of Congress. Area code 202-225-3121. Let them know you'd like something done about this. Let your local media know, too. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. So glad to have you back with us. Peter Phillips is with us, Dr. Peter Phillips. He manages the Sonoma State University's student-run media research group. It's called Project Censored. Hey, Dr. Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here, Tom.
Oh, very glad to have you right here in the studio with us here in Portland, Oregon. Tonight in Portland, at Portland State University, you guys are going to be passing out your awards.
We did that last weekend, actually, at Sonoma State University, and I'm just speaking at Portland State tonight to a group of people there. So,
okay.
We had our award winners Saturday night from all over the country came into Sonoma State, and I remember that 2 years ago you were an award winner.
Yep.
And had two stories in the 2004 book.
Yep.
About corporate personhood and corporations lying to the public.
Yes.
So it's good to meet you in person.
It's great meeting you, Peter, and I was very, very honored to be to have been included in the book, and I'm very pleased to put Project Censored award winning, you know, in my bio. It's good company.
It's a way, you know, you kind of get censored by corporate media, but in the other sense, it's saying, and 200 faculty and students are saying, that was a darn good story.
Yeah. Yeah, and there were some darn good stories in each one of these books. And what you guys do is you turn this into a book, and the book is, of course, available in bookstores all across the country. And it's called this year it's called Censored 2006, Media Democracy in Action.
Exactly.
There you go. So people can check that out. ProjectCensored.org, the website. And Peter Phillips, what is – let's just, you know, look go through a few of these things. The Bush administration has – made some really substantial moves to shut down the access of we the people to the information about what's going on inside our government. This really contradicts the foundational notions of democracy, and yet I doubt most Americans even know what's going on.
Well, we had the Freedom of Information Act that has been in public law now for some close to 30 years, and that we've been whittling away at that. So the Reagan administration, Bush 1, and Bush 2 now, I mean, they're really shutting down how we can get access to government information. They keep coming up with new exceptions, new secrets. Current military operations are now exempt. Environmental impact report for military bases, that you can't really find anything out. Anything that has to do with weapons of mass destruction, anything that has to do with corporations telling things that they've done wrong to government, is not public information. I mean, if they've promised to correct it, then it's not part of EPA's
really?
Report.
So if you or I confess to a crime as a human being, if we go in and say, yesterday I was over at the Walmart and I shoplifted a candy bar, and they decide to arrest us, that becomes part of a public record. Arrest records are public. And take our
but
pictures.
With corporations, you promise not to do it again, it's okay.
Well, it's not just okay.
It's secret. Yes, it's proprietary.
And I can't go to the government and say, you know,
let me have that information.
Right.
No,
I can't. There's no way.
That's where they're closing the doors.
Now, the Bush administration, you said the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, I'm assuming you mean both Bush administrations. Didn't Clinton reverse that? I mean, he went on a declassifying binge, as I recall. I know at least with regard to the Kennedy assassination, a lot of documents got declassified.
Well, that was ancient process? History.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, one of the first things Bush got in when he got in was to delete the records and to hold the records on the presidency from his father.
Right.
And Clinton was there was some things that Clinton opened up, but there was a lot of things that had to do with the war against Serbia and the double dealing that went on there that didn't get covered in the corporate media. And we really didn't know about. I mean, the Rambouillet Treaty had a section in it that would have allowed NATO troops to occupy Yugoslavia. And, of course, Milosevic wasn't going along with that, whether we liked him or not. We kind of forced the hand on that. So there was plenty of stuff that went on during the Clinton administration as well.
Interesting. That never got covered.
That never
got
covered, yeah.
So how do you know that?
Well, it was published in independent media in Europe mm-hmm. and other places. And But here, Clinton used a group called the Rendon Group to help make that war look like it was a humanitarian war.
Right.
And Rendon Group now works for the White House and helps process the Iraq war today.
So if the we've digressed a little bit, but I want to get back to the book, but I find this fascinating. If the because I don't, frankly, I have to confess, I don't know that much about that particular war, the Bosnian War. I was in other places doing other things at the time. I wasn't even in the United States for some of it. And if it wasn't a humanitarian war, I mean, we saw for weeks, you know, the siege of Sarajevo and, you know, people starving and people being shot at by snipers.
It was a terrible civil war.
Yeah. And so if our intervention was not humanitarian, why did we do it?
Well, there's we broke up what was the last remaining socialist country in Europe. That was a motivating factor right from the beginning, and the Germans and the U.S. were very much involved. When the Mujahideen quit fighting in Afghanistan, we actually helped airlift several thousand of them into Bosnia to fight against the Serbs. And that happened in 92. And so this whole thing just got stirred up. I mean, and that's been part of what, you know, there's nobody innocent in this.
Yeah, no, if that happened in 92,
civil
that would have been stuff that was set up.
Civil wars are nasty relationships.
Sure.
And so there's no innocentness here. The drugs, the main drugs from Afghanistan were flowing through mostly to Europe through the KLA in Kosovo. Now Camp Bond Steel is one of the biggest military bases in the world. It's plopped right in the middle of Kosovo where they want to build an oil pipeline across there. So when they bring the oil across the Black Sea from the Caspian Sea area and they bring it across the Black Sea, it doesn't have to go through Turkey and the straits there, which are so narrow. They can just pump it right straight across Kosovo into the Mediterranean on the other side.
So the oil companies benefited. The illegal drug trade benefited.
There were lots of corporations that benefited and continue to benefit. I mean, Halliburton and Brown and Root operate that whole big base there, making millions of dollars in Kosovo.
Yeah.
And we put NATO bases all throughout in Croatia and Bosnia. So we've occupied the region, broken it up, balkanized the entire place. And really, it's created Yugoslavia really was a first world country in many aspects. It was highly developed, and it's become pauperized. And we left a permanent radioactive landscape with depleted uranium weapons throughout Serbia.
Right, not unlike what we're doing in Iraq right now.
No, exactly.
Now, if this started in 92, that was the last year of Bush Sr.'s administration, was it not?
Well,
so Clinton
was never
inherited this?
Clinton was never supposed to get in. Yes, he did inherit it. He was never supposed to get in. And, you know, a lot of times...
As president, you mean?
Right. He was a governor. Bush was supposed to continue. And it really threw a monkey wrench into the global dominance group, which is the PNACers and the people who are in power today, the Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Khalilzad. I mean, that whole group that were looking for after the collapse of the Soviet Union for the U.S. to go ahead and have the New World Order where we're going to create a top-down control militarily of the entire globe. Clinton didn't follow that agenda exactly the way we wanted it. And they were writing letters to Clinton saying it's time to invade Iraq in 98.
Sure.
And all of that was coming forward. And
writing
reports.
I mean, those letters are still on the Project for New American Century's
website. They're still on their website, exactly,
yeah.
With, you know, the signatures of the people who are in power today.
Yeah, including Jeb Bush and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and Rumsfeld
and
Cheney. Yeah.
And a bunch of those were Northrop Grumman people, Lockheed Martin people. Who really have benefited from the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq and continue to make, they're the most profitable corporations in the country next to media.
Right, which means in the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this really is a perfect segue into the issue of, okay, here's all this stuff that's been going on. Most people don't know about it. I confess, as I said, with regard to Serbia anyway, I'm certainly not a scholar of that war. And I don't think most Americans are informed about these things. You suggest in the title of your book, Censored 2006, and the whole, you know, Project Censored, that there is censorship in America, that there's a reason, that there is a force preventing us from knowing these things.
Well, the corporate media has been narrowed down to 10 major media corporations. They're interlocked with the military-industrial complex. They tell us what they think they want us to hear.
Right.
And you have to go to independent news, independent talk, Air America, Pacifica, you know, news, to really find out what's different. Because the big corporate news is telling you the way they want you to hear it. And they hire PR firms to write and produce videotapes for news content, write stories, and even create stories. I mean, we all remember the story about the incubator babies in the first Gulf War. I mean, that was a Helen Nolan fictitious creation.
Right.
Whereby, you know, the ambassador's daughter from Kuwait goes on, says she's a nurse from the Kuwaiti hospital and that the Iraqis had invaded and stole the incubators and dumped the babies on the floor.
And
it was a lie, and they knew it.
Out.
And they knew it.
The
weapons
media...
of mass destruction was a lie, and we should have known it. And Judith Miller got away with that
for
a long time. And we're starting to see that and to recognize the degree to which corporate media will feed from PR firms and the State Department and the Pentagon and the White House. And this isn't just Bush. I mean, this was Clinton as well. I mean, we get accused of being sort of the right-wing bashers of Bush, but you know, but look at our books in 96, 7, 8, and 9. You know, we were saying the same things about the administration in power then.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Peter Phillips. He manages the Sonoma State University's student-run media research group, Project Censored. We're going to go through a couple of these Project Censored stories. If you have a question for Dr. Phillips, our number 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. We have in the studio today Peter Phillips. Dr. Peter Phillips, he is the manager of the Sonoma State University student-run media research group, Project Censored. And they're just out with Censored 2006, the top 25 censored stories in America. And we were just talking about how censorship happens or doesn't happen. I wonder to what extent. I've often thought that there were really two big events that led to this situation. I mean, if you go back and you look historically, for the first couple hundred years, more or less, you could arguably go back to the rise of William Randolph Hearst. But for the first couple hundred years, you had in cities multiple newspapers that had multiple political viewpoints. You know, I grew up in Michigan, and Detroit, you had the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News. One was a labor paper, the other was a business paper. One had a labor section, the other had a business section. You know, one had a Republican tilt, the other had a Democratic tilt. And the Republican paper would even carry stuff from the John Birch Society, and the Democratic paper would even carry stuff from the Socialist Worker. The whole spectrum of discussion was out there.
Exactly.
And this isn't that long ago. This was 1960s, you know, when I was a teenager. And then in 87, Reagan suspended the Fairness Doctrine, and along with that, the obligation of broadcast media to serve the public in exchange for the airwaves. And then in 96, Clinton signs the Telecommunications Act, and it seemed like those two things together, those were really the major, combined with in 1980 when Reagan effectively stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and allowed all these, you know, allowed non-media corporations to start buying up media. You get these three things together, and now what we have are corporations who are really kind of infotainment providers. And nobody is attending to the news anymore. Am I missing something?
You're pretty accurate. I mean, it goes all the way back to the 1934, and where we allowed commercial radio, privately owned radio for profit, to enter into and be part of the radio networks in the country. Before that, it was basically churches and universities and small towns. And it was a big fight back then. I mean, McChesney documents this well in his history on the media stuff. And, so we really had a major debate, and we lost that debate, and we're still losing it. Because media now is consolidated into these 10 big corporations. Half the radio stations in the country have gotten bought up since 1996.
Yeah.
And that was the Clinton thing that passed the Telecommunications Act. And then just the last 2 years, the resistance to Michael Powell's attempt to even further allow consolidation of radio, television, and newspapers all owning each other in the same cities up to 45% market share got blocked.
Right.
It got blocked by a federal court. I mean, it got through the Senate, tried to block it, but then they couldn't get it through the House because Tom DeLay was blocking it there. But millions of Americans stood side by side and said no to further media consolidation. This was the National Rifle Association on the right, MoveOn.org on the left, and saying, you know, we don't want that. We want a diversity of news. We want local programming. We want people to be able to talk about issues, democratic issues, in our own communities and bring that to a macro level.
It's not just the issue, though, of is it for-profit corporations running this? Because for-profit companies were publishing newspapers in the United States in 1790, and newspapers were taking political sides and having knockdown, drag-out debates and calling politicians liars and exposing things. And it really seems that it's not so much whether it should be a not-for-profit or for-profit system or a publicly owned or a privately owned system so much as the point that Teddy Roosevelt kept making back in, you know, in the 19-teens, the early 19-teens when he was forming the Bull Moose Party, which is the whole issue of there is a point at which business gets so big that it becomes toxic to democracy.
Exactly. But we really didn't commercialize till after the Civil War. And that's where we saw newspapers really develop advertising as their main source of revenue. Before that, it was political parties and interest groups that were supporting newspapers in every city.
Well, and they were subsidized. Up until the Civil War, we subsidized with our tax dollars the manufacture of newsprint. And we continue to this day to subsidize the postage, the delivery of newspapers.
And make it easier.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, you go to any Europe, I mean, you go to Athens, there's 15 dailies. You know, you go to, in Rome, there's a dozen. And so you get a variety of viewpoints.
The dozen in Rome, though, half of them are owned by Silvio Berlusconi.
Unfortunately,
I mean,
yes.
You know, he keep in mind, I mean, Italy is a... I do Berlusconi alerts here on the program all the time because Italy is such a case in point. Here's this guy. He bought a radio station. He bought a TV station. He buys another radio station. He buys a radio network. He buys a TV. Pretty soon he owns virtually all the media in Italy. He owns most of the magazines, most of the newspapers, all
he's,
of the radio
he's
and
a
TV
media,
networks. And then he runs,
and
for,
then,
a prime
then he
minister.
Runs for prime minister.
And guess what? He wins. And now we're finding...
And our books sell in Italy. They're translated in Italian, and they sell great.
That's great. And now we're finding that the forged Niger uranium documents that came that Bush was quoting in his speech came out of Italian intelligence in an apparent attempt on the part of Berlusconi to suck up to George Bush because he was having political... Berlusconi was having political problems because he was getting backlash for all of his shenanigans.
And Joe Wilson steps forward to tell that, and then he gets bashed and his wife gets outed. And,
and here we are.
And maybe we'll have indictments by tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, the minute we have indictments, within seconds anyway, of the time that we have indictments, we will also have a new candidate for the Supreme Court. These guys are so good at playing the media, which keeps bringing.
Well,
us
exactly.
Back to
I'm sure
this
that I'm
the
sure
media.
The groups are working on it right now. What are we going to divert once that happens? What big event can happen that we can divert from?
Yeah, I want to get back to these stories. We've got these top 10 stories anyway. At least touch on them. We'll do that after this break. We're talking with Dr. Peter Phillips. He's Sonoma State University's student-run media research group, Project Censored. He's the manager of that. The book Censored 2006 is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 26 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Project Censored 2006 is out. Censored 2006, Dr. Peter Phillips, the director of Project Censored. He manages the Sonoma State University student-run media research group called Project Censored. They award prizes to the top 25 stories every year which are underreported by the mainstream media. Would that be a good way of saying it?
Well, or zero reported by the mainstream media, but
yeah, in some cases. Okay, let's get into these here, and just give our listeners an overview of what, in the opinion of you and your students who did some really serious research for this thing, were the top stories.
Well, there's 100 PhDs that are in on the evaluation, plus 100 students and our national judges. So
that's great.
A lot of people have looked at it.
So we talked about the Bush administration move to eliminate open government, Fallujah and the civilian death toll. This was your number two story.
This is number two. This is about the research done by Johns Hopkins University that came out just a year ago that verified 100,000 civilian deaths in Iraq since we had invaded, mostly by aerial bombing, and well over half being women and children in their own homes.
Yeah. Now, I hear that number used fairly regularly. Is it never used in the maybe
well,
I'm just not
saw,
a big consumer,
you,
consumer
when,
of
when
mainstream
the,
media.
They had the 2,000 soldiers that had died yesterday. AP did a story. In that story, they said that that about 3,000 civilian casualties that occurred since our invasion.
You're kidding?
No, that's what they said. And then they said that there's other sites that say maybe as many as 14,000. They didn't even mention the study, which was a national survey done by a university interviewing families all over the country, verifying a minimum of 100,000 civilian casualties, plus hundreds of thousands of more injured.
Sure.
and not even mentioned. So it becomes like it didn't happen. Yet all over the world, all over Europe, and people know this.
Yeah.
And they know the civilian casualties that have happened.
Well, and
they, and then what happened in Fallujah?
Yeah, and within at least a generation or so of memory, they've had the actual experience of war on their land, and we
yes.
haven't. And so they know that you can't have a war without having huge civilian casualties. You can't bomb Baghdad without killing people.
Exactly.
And somehow Americans think it's a video game, and Europeans,
and laser guided missiles and everything, and it's not. I mean, we're large numbers of people are dying.
Yeah.
And when we invaded Fallujah, we surrounded the city. We told everybody to get out. 50,000 people were trapped inside. They either couldn't get out or they were mailed.
This is a city of 300,000 or 400,000 people.
300,000 or 400,000 people. Or they were mailed between 50 and 45, which we didn't let out. And then we went in and turned it into a free fire zone. And literally shot up. A third of the buildings were destroyed. The whole city looks like it was just devastated. And several thousand civilians died. We cut off the water, cut off the power, and we just went in there and went crazy.
And
we used napalm, and they call it MK-77 to deny that it's using. But, I mean, the UN voted to ban the use of napalm or incendiary bombs in civilian areas in 1980. But the U.S. never signed on to the protocol. We denied it, but now it's come out completely. There's no doubt. That we've been using napalm-type weapons.
Well, it was reported hugely in the British press, in fact.
Exactly, and they were outraged by it.
Yeah, and I was reading those stories here on this radio program. Another year of distorted election coverage, your number three story for the year.
Well, you've been talking about this today, but there was, 8 million vote discrepancy between the exit polls and how the actual results came out, the official results.
Yeah, the exit polls showed John Kerry won.
Winning by 5 million votes.
Right, the electronic voting machines showed that George W. Bush won.
Yes.
By about 3 million votes. And
the statistical possibility of that happening are in excess of 100,000 to 1. And in some states.
Against that happening. Yeah.
And in some states, they're millions to 1. Because we had a variation up to 9, 10%. If you do a poll of somebody who's just walked out of having voted, you've got a 99.5% accuracy rate. I mean, it's just the most perfect poll you can do. They polled 13,000 people nationally. They would not release the data until after the inauguration. So once we got a hold of the data, statisticians are able to look at it and say, wait a minute, this is impossible.
Yeah.
These states could not have done this. And it wasn't just in Ohio. It was in a dozen states.
Then Matofsky Edison came up with this theory of the shy Republicans.
The shy Republicans.
Only in a few states, and only in the last 2 hours of the polling did the Republicans become shy.
But the data doesn't support that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's still their official story, and they're sticking to it. And now you've got, former Enron lobbyist and RNC chairman Ed Gillespie came out saying no more exit polls.
If that was true,
the Republicans.
Then you wouldn't run into the problem that the exit polls were only wrong in one direction.
Right.
Favoring Bush. And that...
exit polls favored Kerry.
Favored Kerry, but they were only wrong in that direction so that the result was a favoring of Bush.
Yeah.
And they were only wrong in almost every case where there was no paper trail in the voting machines.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's impossible. It's just impossible.
And Americans are not scratching their heads about this.
Well, we certainly should be.
Yeah, but again, this is one of the stories.
The Baker-Carter Election Commission report in April and June, they came out and say, well, we had problems. Voter registration wasn't right, again, in Florida and other places, and there was manipulation. People had to wait too long in line, but they didn't say they said there was no fraud.
Yeah.
And there is evidence of fraud, and it's quite widespread.
Along those lines, let's just pause for a moment here and take a call. Jesse in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jesse, you're live with me and with Dr. Peter Phillips.
Well, I'm very happy to be. I am so sick of hearing politicians talk about what should be done about the voting machines. They are just pacifying us. So I think we need to go to the source. I think Americans need to hit Diebold in the pocketbook or give them a black eye by protesting Diebold, by petitioning Diebold, by boycotting Diebold. The irony is I am sure our tax money pays for this corrupt voting machines, which are not even voting machines. They're illusionary machines. They're illusion machines. And we need to make noise and let the complicit know Americans are not going to let our votes be tampered with anymore.
So are you suggesting that if your bank is using a Diebold ATM that you shouldn't use it? Is that...
I'm suggesting that we need to make noise against Diebold because they are taking money from the right
or they're taking money from the left. I don't know who they're taking money for. They're getting
Well, they're making money. I mean, it's a for-profit corporation, Jesse.
Petition against them. I think we need to hold them accountable for making paperless machines. They should refuse orders of making paperless machines, and we need to give them a black eye. I am so sick of hearing politicians talk about this because, you know, come election time, nothing is going to change.
Yeah,
so
well said. But Jesse, you know, Dr. Phillips, the point that Jesse makes is, you know, I think a lot of people think that, for example, you can vote with your dollars. You know, if you don't like Walmart, don't go to Walmart. But if we go to a mentality of voting with your dollars, that means that the people with the most dollars have the most votes, and that's not democracy. Also, Diebold isn't, number one, Diebold isn't the only company. I mean, one of these voting
Sequoia
machines.
Sequoia and ESS.
Yeah,
yes.
ESS, you know, that Chuck Hagel used to run, and Sequoia is, I believe, owned by Venezuelan nationals now, one of whom was just denied access into the United States. Am I not correct?
Well, we know that Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman have major investments in the voting machine companies.
Right.
And that they're, you know, so they have interests in that.
But the much, much larger issue here, beyond just is one particular company corrupt or is one particular company okay or whatever, is that the United States of America is the only fully developed democracy in the world, industrialized democracy in the world, that allows private for-profit corporations to hold our vote. I mean, this is the most sacred part of the commons. This is nuts that we are saying, you know, our vote, the way by which we administer our government, which is the means through which we administer all of our commons, that our vote is going to be privatized. It's going to be outsourced to a private for-profit corporation. How did this ever happen?
This has got to be everybody who believes in democracy responding and saying, no, I want to see my vote counted. I want to put it on paper. I want a copy. I want to make sure that the people locally in my own precinct who I know can count those votes and turn them in, and there isn't any centralized computer system that can be hacked from the outside to be able to change the results of what we're doing. And we're going to have to stand on that, or we've lost it.
Yeah. Phil in Tampa, Florida, you're live and on the air. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Yeah, I think my call really gels into this. We used to have a law in the United States that provided for free discussion, and I lost the context.
Talking about the Fairness Doctrine?
Yeah. Let me give you and the response of the right is that, oh, you don't have to worry about it because we take everybody's calls. In fact, Rush Limbaugh likes to say that liberals get to the top of the line when they call in. I called your show, Tom, during the hurricane was hitting, and we lost power even though we weren't hit, but I was here in Tampa. So I lost my computer and everything else. The only thing that worked was my battery radio. So I wanted to get a weather report and went to the station that has Limbo on it. So just for the heck of it, the phone still worked. So just for the heck of it, I called the 800 number and got through. And the guy says, yeah, he says, Rush Limbo show. And I said, well, I want to disagree with Rush. You know, I see you guys are not interested. You know, you guys were thinking, you guys are saying that the issue of lying is not really that important. It shouldn't be prosecuted.
Phil, we've only got about 30 seconds left here. I need you to shorten your story.
And so I said, well, you sure didn't feel that way about Clinton. He said, well, Clinton lied under oath. I said, yeah, the government asked him about his sex life, and he didn't want to tell him. Big deal. And he says, good try, pal, and hung up on me.
This is the call screener?
Yeah.
Amazing. Well,
and
Phil,
this is not the first time this has happened to me getting through to Limbaugh.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to be a sycophant and you're going to say, oh, Rush, I love you, you're not getting through.
Yeah. Well, that's tragic. I mean, as you know, Phil, from calling this program, our call screening is entirely, what's your name, what's your city, and in one sentence, tell us what you want to talk about. And if I see on the screen that it's somebody who's wants to violently disagree with me, I actually do put them at the top of the list. Anyway, we're gonna be back with Peter Phillips in just a minute. It's the Tom Hartman program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Looking down the nose of what people say, these words and words okay, is what
what you do and not what you say. If you're not part of the future, then get out of the way.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Peter Phillips with us. Project Censored, Sonoma State University's. You guys have turned this thing from what I'm guessing was just a small idea into a huge thing.
It's really grown, yeah. 1.5 million hits on our website in the first 2 weeks of October.
This is when the new one came out?
Yeah. It's just, we get a couple million a month anyway. But
yeah. Projectcensored.org, the website we're
talking
about. Exactly.
And when Carl founded it, I mean, this is our 29th year of doing this.
Oh, really? So, I had no idea it was that long.
It's been, Carl Jensen did it for 20 years, and then I've been director for the past 9.
That's great. Well, I'm honored to be part of it, to have won one of your awards and to be in one of your books. And although it's been a couple of years, I'll have to...
I'll have to do it again.
I'm gonna have to get back to writing more and I guess talking less. Some of the top stories that were censored in 2005 that are out in your censored 2006. This is 2005. These are really the top stories that were censored in 2004.
As of March and April last year. So.
Yeah.
That's when we had to shut it off, and then we write the book, and it comes out in the spring. I mean, it comes out in the fall. But if we call it 2005, everybody's going to think it's old news by the time it gets on the bookshelves.
Yeah,
we call it 2006 like almanacs.
Right, yeah.
And,
which makes sense in the publishing world.
Yeah, it does.
But these are really the most underreported or unreported stories in 2004. Numbers 8 and 9, Iraqi farmers threatened by Bremer's mandate and Iran's new oil system challenges U.S. currency. There's a bit of a threat, I suppose, between the two. Well, let's just take them one at a time. Iraqi farmers threatened by Bremer's mandates. I don't think most Americans know what Bremer's mandates were.
They went in and they just issued 100 different directives that were very pro-corporation, very pro-U.S. privatizing the economy of Iraq.
They were trying to create a libertarian paradise.
Something to that effect.
Yeah.
Let
me just toss this out at you, Peter, and see what you think of it. My take on what they were trying to do in Iraq was they said, you know, those nasty liberals, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, when they rebuilt Europe and Japan, they gave them strong labor unions and universal health care and all the things that they couldn't get here in the United States because Republicans started blocking them after they took the House and Senate in the election of 46. And so they did that in Europe and Japan to try and prove that they were right. And we're gonna go into Iraq and we're gonna remake Iraq as a conservative paradise and prove that it'll be even more successful than Europe was. And they did, and it's not.
And it's not.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, $100 million went to re-educate. That's in quotes. Iraqi farmers to do more industrial size harvests so they can export more products. And they're getting them to buy genetically engineered seeds from Monsanto and other corporations so that they have to permanently buy those seeds. And so we've put the GMO issue right into Iraq. They didn't have it before. And now they're growing crops, and we're marketing those crops for them for the international market instead of the subsistence market and feeding people there. We're building the stuff for export. And this was mandated. This was imposed upon the Iraqi farmers by Bremer.
And is there not a provision in either the Hague Conventions or somewhere in the UN Conventions or the Geneva Conventions that says that if you take a country in war, if you defeat a country in war, you occupy a country in war, that you cannot change their constitution until they have their own government? In other words, only their own government can change their constitution. And yet that's what Bremer did.
He completely went in. They rewrote what was going on, and they basically set up and told the puppet government in Iraq today how they wanted to see that constitution laid out.
Right. Yeah.
And they federalized it and broken the country up into 3 segments, 2 with oil, 1 without. And so they've and that's part of what the resistance is about today. I mean,
sure.
People just simply aren't going to tolerate that.
Yeah, in part it's religion, in large part it's economics, and that's a huge part of the untold story. Now, just before Bush invaded Iraq, Saddam Hussein was talking about denominating his oil in euros.
He did it.
And he did it, okay.
He did. He was selling oil in euros, and that was the first thing Bremer did when he got back there.
He flipped it to dollars.
Now
the Iranians are talking about creating an oil bourse, a trading floor, that will denominate oil in euros.
Exactly.
And we're now talking about invading Iran. Do you see, does A equal B here?
That's one of our top stories this year, and people don't know that. I mean, the U.S., the dollar is used as the oil mark in the oil market worldwide. So Japan has to buy oil in dollars. China buys oil in dollars. I mean, they need the dollars to buy the oil. If that switched,
therefore we can run at a deficit.
Exactly. If that switched, we would see massive inflation in the U.S.
Right.
And so that's something they're really trying to block and militarily enforce.
Right, because our currency would no longer be needed by the world, so people would all over the world would no longer be buying our debt
exactly.
and taking our IOUs.
And China's one of the biggest, but Chavez in Venezuela is trading oil for doctors to Cuba. And making other agreements in Latin America to sell oil. He's selling oil to the Chinese directly, and it's in dollars right now, but it could easily not be.
Yeah, and if, well, here's the thing. I mean, if Chavez says, okay, it's not going to be in dollars anymore, the day later, is Chavez still in power?
Maybe a day or two.
but I mean, you know, here seems to be this kind of
there's a real
pattern. You know,
yes.
Oil-rich countries say
we've already tried to take him out once, so we'll
now,
see.
Now, didn't the Saudis about 3 or 4 years ago talk about trading in gold riyads instead of dollars, and that like went away really fast? That got floated.
The Saudis are totally dependent on the U.S. for protection.
Yeah.
I mean, they're running a kingdom there, repressing a whole lot of people inside of Saudi Arabia, and are incredibly rich in the process. So they're very dependent upon U.S. Support.
Yeah, so they're not going to rock
the
boat.
They're not going to rock the boat.
Interesting. I remember the whole story of the gold riyad coming out. Dr. Peter Phillips manages Sonoma State University's student-run media research group, Project Censored, the website projectcensored.org. Dr. Phillips, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
So much to have you. So nice to have you here in the studio. Good luck on this. It's a great book, a wonderful project. Book is out, Censored 2006. You can check it out. You can buy it. Bookstores all over the country. Projectcensored.org, the website. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks so much for being with us today, my friends. We will see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
So your kid's smoking pot, and now you're afraid to say something because they might...